It's Monday, August 10th, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington in New York, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, with the day's stories, Jack Farley.
Thanks, Ash. As you know, legendary investor Warren Buffett shocked the financial world in May when he announced his company Berkshire Hathaway had divested totally of its airline holdings. Since then, investors have turned to the investing titan for inspiration and hope, but the Oracle of Omaha has been silent. He's been giving the investors neither as he sat on a huge and growing pile of cash that he was unwilling to deploy. He made a small acquisition with Dominion Energy, and he bought some Bank of America shares as well. But this isn't the same Warren Buffett who pumped $5 billion into Goldman during 2008, or the Warren Buffett who became acting CEO of Salomon Brothers, for God's sakes. However, Berkshire announced its Q2 earnings on Saturday, and the results may rouse the flagging spirits of fundamentally driven investors. Warren Buffett decided he wanted to put some capital to work. He scanned the investment landscape, all the stocks in the world, and he determined that the best thing for Berkshire Hathaway to buy would be Berkshire Hathaway. That's right, Berkshire bought back a record $5.1 billion worth of its own shares through June 30th, and analysts are estimating that Berkshire conducted an additional $2.4 billion worth of buybacks through the rest of July. Berkshire reported over $26 billion in net earnings for the second quarter, but it really isn't that rosy. As Buffett is quick to remind, this GAAP metric includes gains and losses on securities, and seeing as Berkshire owns over $200 billion worth of equities, this metric really isn't that useful. If you factor out the $31 billion in capital appreciation for Q2, Berkshire actually lost money, as even though operating earnings were in the black at $5.5 billion, admittedly down 10% year over year, the company incurred almost $11 billion in capital impairment, most of which were incurred on Precision Cast Parts, a manufacturer of airplane parts that Berkshire acquired in 2016 for $37.2 billion. Revenues for Precision Cast Parts were down 32.5% compared to Q2 2019, and as Berkshire noted in its 10Q, earnings as a percentage of revenues are expected to continue to be negatively impacted through 2020 due to inefficiencies associated with aligning operations to reduce aircraft build rates. This as PCC has already eliminated 10,000 jobs in a solemn restructuring plan. So it's a stark reminder that Buffett's exit of the airlines may have actually been prudent, even if, say, American Airlines is up 7% today. Oh, and also, even though Berkshire bought back at least $5 billion of its own stock, it was actually a net seller of equities in the second quarter by almost $13 billion. So it seems that while Buffett's confidence in the stock market has not been restored, the Oracle of Omaha's faith in Berkshire remains undimmed. Back to you, Ash.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Jack. Welcome, Ed.
Good to be here, Ash.
Always a pleasure. Ed, let's dive right in. What are you thinking about this afternoon?
Yeah, I'm trying to put together some of the recent interviews that I've had into sort of a thesis about what's happening in terms of an inflection point or potential inflection point in the market. And I'm hoping maybe you can help me walk through this over the next 20 minutes or so. It's Milton Berg, the interview that I did with him that came out today. And then I have another interview that I did on Friday that's coming out tomorrow with Charlie McElligott. And the two of them really have made me think about the market narrative and what's happening right now.
Yeah, I haven't seen Milton Berg yet uncharacteristically, and I'm curious to hear what you talked about Charlie McElligott with.
Yeah, you know, I mean, let me tell you about Milton Berg for a second. What we can start with that. I think what we talked about is we talked about the market crashing down into the March 23rd low and then coming back out. and then a bunch of buy signals coming out for the market around June the 8th to the 11th, which is, by the way, interestingly enough, the period where the Fed had the maximum exposure on its balance sheet. Its balance sheet was the biggest. It's actually rolled off somewhat since that period of time. And the interesting bit is those buy signals, they came at a very weird time, 2.5 times after the actual low. You would expect the buy signals to happen earlier. And moreover, the price action that's happened since the buy signals have been given, it's been very interesting. It's been very strange. So, he said that June 8th of 2020 was the peak for a lot of markets. And, usually he would be thinking about this as a turning point. But at the same time, he had a bunch of markers that showed that actually maybe you'd have a bullish sign. I think, for instance, he said this S&P 500 5-day breadth that's ups versus down was 3.0 to 1. That's the first time that we've had that since 2014, which is a rare occurrence. That was right at that particular point. So things like that. So interestingly, since that time, almost all of the indices have actually underperformed relative to what you think that they should do. The Russell 2000 has gained 0.5%. 0.56%, and it hadn't held its high. That's when I spoke to him last. The S&P Small Cap Index has held below that level of June 8th when I last talked to him. So it's very strange what's happened in terms of this. And one of the things that he postulates is maybe it's not a buy signal, but it's a sell signal, a lot of these signals, because the equities have turned from acting like equities into more of a commodity-like market. So I'm still getting my head around that, and I'm trying to think about it in the context of another interview that I had, which is going to come out tomorrow.
So what does he suspect now, or what's his operating thesis based on what he's learned since June 8th about these signals? What do they suggest going forward for example, the rest of August and September, which is one of the timeframes that you've been talking about?
Yeah, so he suggests, as I said, that it could be that it's the opposite signal of what we think it is. I'm just looking at some of the drawdown numbers that he's talking about. I'm looking to see if I can find this in some of my notes that I took from what he was talking about. He said that, on June the 8th, that was the sixth time that the net upside volume as a percentage of total volume was greater than 40%. It was actually January of 1987 that was the last time that happened. And then you saw a 25% gain on average in the 12 months after that. And during that period of time, after this has happened, usually in the immediate following, you never had a drawdown of more than 0.8% until now, in which case the small cap was down over a 13% drawdown after June the 8th. And you also saw the S&P with a drawdown of 7%. So his thinking is that this anomalous behavior at what you would think would be a incredible buy signal is actually not a buy signal. It could be a sell signal because you have commodity-like momentum building up in the equity markets. Very, very fascinating interview. And I'm still trying to, think about it and what it means into this sort of September to October period that I always talk about. And Charlie McElligott, who I spoke to on Friday, what he talks about in terms of September.
Very interesting. And what are your sort of preliminary thoughts on how that does or does not match up with some of your thoughts about that time period, September, October?
Yeah, well, let me put it in the McElligott context, because he was talking about that September to December is a pro-cyclical risk-on period usually, and that he thinks that there could be an inflection point in September in particular, from crowded trades. And he looks at all of these crowded trades. Let me just give you an example. Triple Q's options long is 97th percentile of the data that he's looking back on. So that means that people are relative to the positioning that he's seen over a very long period of time, 97th percentile in terms of their optionality, their long optionality. And so given that crowded trade, any sort of a pain trade on the other side could give you a very sharp reversal. And what he's talking about is all of these plays are actually bond proxies. This is where I get into what Milton Berg was telling me is that maybe actually what's going on with the huge momentum trade that we're seeing with regard to the long on bonds, long on gold, long on silver, long on growth is actually a somewhat bearish, if you will, economic trade. It's actually not a hugely reflationary, it works reflationary trade. It's more sort of a stagflationary or a secular stagnation type of scenario. And this is where I'm coming in. I'm sort of just working this out live with you here as I'm thinking about it. But I think that these two interviews really helped me think about how to position this mentally. And so one of the things is if you think, as McElligott thinks, that it's a bond proxy, all of these trades, that means if you go from a bull flattening, which is what you've seen in terms of the bonds going long, to a bear steepening, all of those trades will sell off, except maybe gold and silver. You don't want to be in growth. You want to potentially make a shift back into to value at that point. So very interesting concept. And I can go on. I have a lot more to say about that, actually.
Oh, please.
Yeah. So let me just say that, the way I'm thinking about it is that what is the trigger to a reversal in the momentum? This is what we saw today in the markets, if you noticed. I mean, this is exactly the trade that Charlie McElligott is talking about, is everyone is leveraged to growth. Why are they leveraged to growth? The answer, I believe, is because they believe that the outperformers like the Amazons, like the Netflix, like the Apples of the world are leveraged to a new world in which COVID-19 is still with us and has a market shift and how we behave. To me, that's not necessarily a world in which growth is strong. It could be a stagflationary, it could be a disinflationary or a secular stagnation type of world. I'll give you an example because I showed you this article literally like 30 minutes before we got on. You said you didn't agree with everything that it was said, but it was interesting. From The Atlantic, there's an article about the coronavirus never going away. And basically what it said is, the coronavirus is simply too widespread and too transmissible for it to be killed off permanently, except through maybe herd immunity. And so that's a world in which you have a continuous need for those growth plays because they will outperform ad infinitum in that world.
Yeah, Ed, that ties into precisely what I've been looking at and thinking about today. There was news flow out on Saturday. Tony Fauci effectively said that the odds of getting a 98% effective vaccine are bad. And scientists are hoping for 75%, though they would approve a 50% vaccine if it were efficacious, if it worked, and was also able to get by the safety checks. Now, to me, this is a pretty extraordinary idea. The idea that, 50% would be acceptable and 75% would be good. This is not a magic bullet that's coming. And for people who've been thinking there's a magic bullet coming from the vaccine researchers, it seems as though Dr. Fauci is at very least trying to manage expectations on that account, and that there's a possibility that we're just not going to get all the way there. And what does that mean for the economy? What does that mean for the day-to-day lives of hundreds of millions of Americans? It sounds like what it means is that we need to function in an environment that has less than 100% immunity from a vaccine, which doesn't yet exist.
Right. Yeah. And, that's not a world I think that's you should call bullish for growth, for economic growth.
Right.
The bottom line for me is when we're talking about a momentum trade that's pro-growth and anti-value, meaning also anti-cyclical. To me, that's a red herring for the concept that that's a bullish outcome, right?
Right.
So you would expect the industrials, the cyclicals, the banks, all to be rallying if we were at the beginning of a new bull market, a new economic cycle. But exactly the opposite is happening.
Yeah, I was going to say they're doing the opposite.
You know, putting together what Milton Berg was saying with what McElligott was saying, or will say to me tomorrow in the interview, is that actually what's happened is that people are, they're actually not going with a maximum bullish reflationary scenario. It's almost the opposite in certain ways. And potentially because you're at the 97th percentile long triple Q options in terms of this trade, there is a pain trade associated with this over the short term. There could be a flip, which we potentially are seeing, and that could extend in particular into September because, as I said, September to December is a pro-cyclical risk-on period. And I should also say that September in particular is a massive issuance month. So you could have a scenario in which rates back up, so you get a bear flat steepener, and that causes all of the trades that people have had to get out of those trades, reverse, reallocate their resources. Volatility spikes up, and it's a very different scenario, at least over the short term. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about it right now.
Yeah, you know, this is really interesting. As you're working through this in real time, I'm working through it with you. And it's a really interesting notion. It almost sounds like what's happening here is the outperformance of these growth stocks is implicit that these companies that are going long are short the call on the economy. And that is to say that they are leveraged toward the notion that economic growth may actually decline and that they're going to get a larger share of perhaps a declining market, but that may outstrip the decline. It's a really interesting thesis.
Right. And, you know, and the way that McElligott put it in terms of how he was talking about was a bond proxy. He said, what if every single one of these plays is basically a bond proxy? That is, when you're talking about a bull flattener, you're basically talking about the Fed being on hold forever. And the only reason the Fed's on hold forever is because growth is lower than the Fed wants it to be for a very long period of time. And what does that mean? That means that you have a substandard economic cycle, and these things are outperforming because you expect them to do, relatively speaking, better in that substandard world. Now, in the COVID world, that's a world in which high touch activity is shunned and low touch activity it becomes much more interesting. And that's a world in which these Amazons, Apples, Netflix, that they do really well.
Yeah, I mean, this is really surreal. It feels like we're through the looking glass here, right? I mean, effectively, the highest growth stocks become a bond proxy relative to growth stocks, which are less desirable under those circumstances. That's interesting and weird.
Yeah, it is. And, going back to what Berg was talking about, he was talking about the relative performance of all of these markets since the June 8th buy signal, potential inflection point that he saw. The NASDAQ was, at the time that I spoke to him, which was, when I first spoke to him, it was actually 2 weeks ago we spoke, but there's been some movement since then. But the NASDAQ was the only index that was up from that June 8th signal. It was up like 9%. The S&P small cap was down. The Russell 2000 was down. The Dow was down. The S&P 500 was, marginally there. But because of its market cap weighted nature, it was all because of, the NASDAQ numbers that it was actually where it was. So basically what you were seeing was every single market since that June 8th period was down, except exactly the companies that we're talking about right now. So again, if you think, okay, actually we're looking at a period that is not bullish from an economic scenario, that fits exactly. So this is where I'm putting, Berg and McElligott together.
Right.
The third piece of that comes out in terms of policy, the policy response. So what we saw in terms of Trump's executive orders.
Yeah.
I don't think those executive orders are going to see the light of day. Secondly, I also think that they're not going to be effective, even if they did see the light of day. All of the information that I've heard since is that it's smoke and mirrors. It's not really going to be a huge stimulus. So yeah. What we're seeing right now is an economy that is rolling over in terms of its growth rate because of the second wave of the coronavirus. And then it's getting a shock from the pullback of fiscal stimulus in the United States.
Let me just jump in there to itemize for our viewers who haven't been following this as closely as you have. So effectively, there are four parts to this. The first is providing a payroll tax deferral holiday. Those taxes are still going to be due later for people who get this holiday. It's not everyone. If you're making over $104,000, you're not eligible for it. But that's a deferral and not a cut. Extended enhanced unemployment benefits, but the enhancement drops from $600 to $400. There is the senior administration. There's something an eviction moratorium, but it only allows senior administration officials to consider whether evictions should be halted as a result of this. So, you know, whether you want to call it smoke and mirrors, if you wanted to be really sort of politically correct, you might call it a compromise plan. But the reality is exactly as you implied, Ed, that this is going to decelerate from the fiscal perspective what's happening right now in the economy.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the way that you want to play it from a political perspective, you know, Trump is doing this. He's saying, look, I'm hooking you guys up by executive order. You guys can't get your act together in Congress, so I'm going to have to do it, step in there. And right. The only people who are going to go against me are people who actually don't want to help you out. That's how he's playing it. That right. I think that's a very good play politically. But the reality in terms of what actually gets done by these executive orders is very dubious, even if they were to see the light of day, which I don't think that they will, just because of the constitutional nature of it, you know, the power of the purse being with Congress. Irrespective, what it says is that there's a lot of downside risk going into September and October. Again, those are the time frames that I'm looking at for the downside risk to materialize in a market outcome in terms of volatility. And we'll just have to see what that means in terms of, you know, whether we get a reversal of these of the momentum trade that has been working so well over Q3 in particular.
Yeah, and I should add to that, whatever the politics are or the optics notwithstanding, some of my very smart lawyer friends have made the same point that you have. It's very dubious whether this would be upheld in the federal courts.
Yeah, you know, but you have to get to the courts first. And then the question is does it make political sense to go to the courts? We'll find out in due course. But I'm not optimistic about the near-term stimulus that we're going to get in the United States. And so I think that there is a downside risk as a result of that.
Yeah. It seems that everything points in the direction right now of downside risk. Everything that we've discussed, either a proxy for downside risk, a leading indicator of downside risk, an effect of downside risk, it just seems as though it's downside risk as far as the eye can see.
Yeah. And so then the question becomes, what does that mean from a market perspective? Does it mean that it's more of the same? Because I just told you that actually maybe these plays are bond plays. So maybe it means you get more of a rally. But at the same time, we're going to have a massive stimulus or massive issuance of treasuries. And normally September through December is a pro-cyclical period. There is the possibility that I would leave open for a reversal of the momentum trade or just a wholesale pancaking of risk on assets to begin with. I'm still working out what I think where this could be headed, but at a minimum, just from an economic perspective, I think that there's risk of downside and there's the risk of higher volatility going forward.
Yeah, if you look at that one-year Treasury chart, there's not a whole lot more room for them to rally and stay positive on the yield front. We're now at 14 basis points.
And let me make one last point on this whole thinking where perhaps the toggle is not directional in terms of the market. This is what Charlie was saying, but it's more in terms of gamma. You know, it's more in terms of increased volatility. That is the concept. If you look back to March and February and you use, you know, a VAR model of deciding how you're going to allocate your resources, you know, what kind of risk you can take, those were high volatility months. Those weeks in February and March, you saw volatility go off the charts. All of those realized vol months are in the back. They've fallen off of your VAR model. So if you are doing any sort of, volatility-based VAR type of leveraging, then that means that any sort of trading that you do is going to see you leverage up as the volatility goes down. Vol control strategies or type of strategies. And the result, therefore, is just right now, as this potential inflection point is going to hit, people are leveraging up into the momentum trades. And that in and of itself will cause a massive reversal to the degree that volatility spikes up in September. And so the move, even though it might seem fairly minor, could be aggressive as a result of that.
Yeah.
It's all market internals as opposed to fundamentals, which would drive that action.
Yeah. VAR, of course, value at risk, a measure commonly used by commercial banks and other financial institutions to measure their total exposure at risk in their portfolios. Ed, you know, talking of this reminds me of the other thing that I wanted to ask you about. There's a deep dive in today's Financial Times about European banks. And the thesis of the article is that European banks have narrower profit margins than their U.S. counterparts and are therefore less able to weather the storm during times of challenging economic times and challenging financial crises. What's not said in the FT article that I think is interesting is that, as you know, Europe is more reliant on traditional bank lending because of less developed capital markets. And the reason that this matters, of course, is because an impact on European banking would have a much larger impact relative to the U.S., for example, on the total amount of credit available in the economy. And it is potentially something significant. I'm curious to get your opinion on this, because you've done a lot of thinking about the response to the virus in Europe versus the United States being largely more favorable. This is interesting because it's one particular domain in which it seems that Europe is more exposed than the U.S. during this crisis.
Yeah, you know, and we were talking about this very briefly right before, and I think my general take was that Europe is more exposed and that's negative for Europe. But let me give a caveat as I think about this. So if you think about credit write-downs, then basically Europe is going to have more credit write-downs on bank balance sheets relative to their GDP if bad things were to happen, as opposed to the United States, where a lot of the risk would be absorbed in the markets. But you know, that's a double-edged sword in this, from a bailout perspective. If you think of all the money that the ECB is shoveling at the banks, or the whole concept of extending and pretending, you have much more of that, to the degree that all the European central authorities are, you know, trying to keep the economy afloat. That allows you to continue to extend and pretend, whereas in the United States, the market-based approach means that it'll be you need active intervention from the central bank into those markets to keep them from having realized volatility. So an example would be that a company, a medium-sized company in Germany goes belly up or is about to go belly up. It could be propped up by an evergreening of the loan by Deutsche Bank in Germany. Whereas in the United States, it would be a junk bond, say, that they issued. And then suddenly that bond would go down in price. It wouldn't be able to renew anything in the markets. You know, banks probably wouldn't lend to it because, you know, why would they lend? Because they're not evergreening a loan. So that company goes bankrupt in the United States, but it doesn't go bankrupt in Europe. So, you know, having a markets-based economy might mean that you have fewer write-downs on bank balance sheets, so that's less of a problem. But overall, I think that you're more exposed to market forces to the degree that the central bank doesn't come in and start monkeying around with those market forces, which they've shown they're willing to do.
Yeah, very well said. So as you said, a double-edged sword for sure. You know, I know we're running low on time here, but one more story that I wanted to talk about. We have a chart of stock availability right now, common goods, household goods, and foodstuffs. This is something that's caught my eye because I don't know about you, Ed, but I spent about an hour wandering around my neighborhood last night trying to get paper towels, and there were none to be had, right? I mean, we started out with a shortage on toilet paper, and now it seems like it's paper towels. They haven't been stocked in my local pharmacy now for a couple of weeks. And it's interesting to see this as more of a national trend. It's not just something idiosyncratic to my neighborhood. This chart that comes to us from the Wall Street Journal shows that that there are a significant number of goods, and it's idiosyncratic in the way that it's being distributed. In other words, it's not distributed evenly. Some goods have worse shortages than others. But what's interesting to me is the aggregate number is that typically there's a 5% out of stock ratio. That's doubled to 10%, and that represents $10 billion in lost revenue. And in addition to that, I would probably argue that there are also some other follow-through effects. There's a sense of anxiety that is exacerbated when people can't get the necessary staple items into their house. I don't know, is that something that you and your family are struggling with? Have you seen this as well?
Yeah, you know, Lysol wipes, I think, they've said that they're back-ordered. They won't be up to normal stock until January. And so we think about those kinds of things. I mean, the way that I think about that from a global perspective, though, is that this is what I would call the shift, which would be, you know, higher inflation and lower growth. Because what's basically happening is that we're all staying at home. We're doing things differently. And therefore, the supply chains have to move to where we are, that, you know, the things that you did in your office space and the way that they got stuff to the office is different than the way that they get stuff to the home. And as a result, the supply chains aren't fully optimized for that transition. And during that period of time, we have the shortage. So during that period of time that you have the shortage, A, prices should be higher, and B, there's going to be lost output as a result of that. So for me, at a minimum, it shows you that we should have lower growth, and we should also have higher prices in the near term. It points back to the scenario that I was talking about just now in terms of the potential for a reversal sort of bear steepening, not necessarily one that is a long-lasting period, but one that's enough to get volatility to spike up and to also get people to get out of these crowded trades and therefore create a lot of uncertainty in financial markets.
Frictions, inefficiencies, volatility, and transition, right? That's like the meta themes of what we've been talking about today. Final note, somewhat amusing story in BBC today about these websites that are piping in office noise to people's homes who are working from home. Sounds like printers, coffee machines, and people chatting in the background. Apparently, these websites that pipe in this background noise are getting hundreds of millions of hits. So I'm sorry, millions of hits, but still, it's a pretty extraordinary thing. And it just, you know, it speaks to the whole theme of this conversation, bizarre transitions and things that are not business as usual. So why not? Why wouldn't buy signals be sell signals and sell signals be buy signals, right? Why wouldn't growth be getting more upside in this environment? I mean, it just all seems like it's of a piece. It's just an incredibly uncertain and unusual time.
It really is. I think to end it on that note would be to say that we have no idea what's happening. We're all just trying to make sense of it now. The question really is when will we get to a stasis period, you know, post pandemic, where we feel like, okay, this is how it's going to be for a relatively long time. We're not there yet.
Well, no matter what the transitions are, the good news is you and I will be back tomorrow.
That's right. All right. You'll be back tomorrow. I think you're talking to someone else. Are we both going to be back?
I don't know, man. So much transition. It's tough to say.
Good to talk to you, Ash.
We'll see you soon.